There you go. Welcome to Sunday school. Let's just start with prayer. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for the Lord's Day. Thank you for your mercies, for your love to us. Thank you that we can once again come to Sunday school to learn more about the government that you have established for your church. We pray that as we observe and learn from biblical principles about how do you rule your church, we may be encouraged, we may deepen our understanding, and we may glorify your name because of it. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right. So we have Presbyterianism part two. And this morning we are going to just kind of like back up a little bit, see the bigger picture about how this big machinery of Presbyterianism work, and then we will narrow down again to see one of the first three parts of Presbyterian government. So we said last time, doctors, elders, deacons, pastor, and we are going to start seeing each one of them in the scriptures and how do we get those four divisions from the scriptures. All right, but the first thing I want to do this morning is for us to see the big picture of Presbyterianism. How does that look like? So if you have your handouts, you will see that I have there the big picture, and it's three major structures in our American Presbyterianism experiment. We have the session, that is the local level, right, composed by elders and the pastor. Then we have the presbytery, which is the meeting of pastors and elders. And then we have of each local congregation in a certain region. And then we have the General Assembly, and which is the meeting of every single pastor and every and two elders from each congregation from a whole bigger area. So if we are in the United States, it's going to be the General Assembly in the whole of North America because we have some Canadians who wanted to be with us. So that's how the General Assembly works. Since I don't want you to stay just with what we do in the PCA, I also brought the other division from the other side of the spectrum, not the other side of the spectrum, but the other side of our cousins, the Continentals. For them, they have the consistory instead of the session. That's the name for the session, consistory. They have the classes for their regional meetings, and they have the synod for their bigger meeting. And we will see there are some differences aside from their names. There are some other things that they do differently. Added to this one, they have another one. It's called council, and the council is the meeting of pastors, elder, and deacons. So one Saturday the deacons meet, the next one the consistory meets, and the next one the council and the consist the deacons and the elders meet together in the council. So that's, I guess, the bigger difference. How does that look like historically speaking? More or less like this: session, presbytery, provincial synod, general assembly, national synod, or simply synod. That's because in different countries you have different regional arrangements. So we have states here, but if you are in France, they have provinces. If you are in the Netherlands, they have provinces. So they have the session at the local level, then the presbytery in the city level. And then if you are going to meet with more than that, then you are going to call the provincial or the statewide level, and that's going to be called the provincial synod. And then a whole region bigger than a province is going to be called the General Assembly. And then bigger than that, if you are calling the whole country to a meeting, that's called national synod or simply synod. All right? So those are just some small differences. The historical arrangement and our present arrangement shows a very important principle. We can accommodate whatever the country or the situation that the church is in. we can accommodate very easily with the biblical model of a government. So whether we have states as an arrangement, or whether we have provinces, central government, whatever the political situation is, Presbyterianism will find a way to exist in those countries. So, for example, in Ecuador, they have the IRPE, how do you translate that? I don't even remember what IRPE means. The Presbyterian Reform and Presbyterian Churches in Ecuador, but it's just five churches in Quito. That's it. And so they call that not presbytery, but I think they call it synod. It's kind of like the same arrangement, but with a different name. It varies depending on where we are at. Does that make sense? Same thing, same levels of a structure, different names. Okay, that's all that it is. In the American development, in our case, the pivot point always has been the presbytery. In other words, the local church is important, but the big dog around the block is the presbytery. That's what is the most important thing. Everything in our denomination turns around the presbytery. That's the most important assembly, so to speak. And that has been the case since ever. Samuel Miller, writing in the 1800s, will define Presbyterianism as the government of the church in which presbytery is central. That's the pivot point of Presbyterianism in America. However, there has been deformation from this arrangement. For example, the PCUSA has the contrary arrangement. Instead of presbytery being at the center, is the General Assembly the one who is at the center. When that happens, then General Assembly can decide whatever they want to decide and then impose it upon the churches, and presbytery and local churches have no saying on it. So they just dictate whatever they want to do and they do it. And that's one of the fears that the Continentals and the Presbyterians had. They didn't want to have another Rome, once again, with a bishop, the moderator, telling you what to do. That's what has happened in the PCUSA. In our arrangement, being the presbytery, the one who rules everything, if General Assembly says something, whatever they want to decide, then it has to come back to presbyteries. We meet again, and we decide whether we like it or not, and then it goes back to General Assembly once again, and then they vote if we have allowed them to vote or not. Does that make sense? So it kind of gives us the liberty to say no to tyrannical decisions. It's just an extra layer of protection for the churches and for the denomination in general. So generally speaking, Presbyterian polity is applied almost similarly in every Reform and Presbyterian denomination. But from time to time, one can find some differences. Let me just quote some of those. My membership in the PCA, guess where is it? I'm not a member of this church. Presbytery. It's in the presbytery. That's the weirdest thing in the world. It doesn't make sense. Calvin, when he's writing about the officers in the church, he says that every pastor should have his own church and that he needs to belong to it, that he is not to be walking from church to church trying to find other flocks and things like that. And he's not to leave that calling unless compelled by providence or any other major reasons regarding that. So when somehow we have pastors becoming members of the presbytery, it becomes really, really weird. But it's because in American Presbyterianism, presbytery is the central gravity place. In the RPCNA, for example, cousins, Presbyterian cousins, the membership is in the local church. So the pastor will be a member of the church. In the URCNA, cousins of third degree, I guess, or second degree, they will be members of the local congregation. Do you know why is that? Because of a different understanding of the local congregation. for the RPCNA and for the URCNA, the local church is the most important thing. God, Jesus Christ rules his church directly through the session or through the consistory in that local church, not through the presbytery. And that makes the pastor member of that church. Because we believe Jesus Christ rules principally through presbyteries instead of local churches, then the pastor is member of the presbytery. You will see there is another difference too. Presbyterians, because of that, they love to celebrate Lord's Supper on presbytery meetings. I don't like that. It always is conflicting to me to see people celebrating the Lord's Supper. And I do partake because I don't want to feel bad leaving myself aside. It's kind of weird. And this is why it's weird. Presbytery exists as a body always. So right now, even though the presbytery is not gathering, it exists as a body. That's why we can celebrate the Lord's Supper on presbytery, because it's a gathering of the church. The question is, where is the church? Do you understand what I'm saying? We are meeting here with God's people, you and the officers, and we are going to celebrate the Lord's Supper. We have biblical warrants for that. We don't have biblical warrants to say, my pastor is meeting with my elders and other pastors and other elders, and they are going to celebrate Lord's Supper. They are a sample of the church, but is that the whole church? That's Calvin's argument against Roman Catholicism too. Calvin is seeing that only the priest with other monks and priests are celebrating the Eucharist, the Mass, and he says they are depriving the whole church of the benefit of the Lord's Supper. So maybe my reasoning is not warranted right there. It's just a continental reaction against celebrating the Lord's Supper. The continentals don't do that. Whenever classes meet, then the body starts to exist. When the classes say, we have finished our business, thank you, brothers, you can go in peace to your places, classes stops existing. It doesn't exist anymore. Yes. They do.
It's not just the elders there, it's whoever comes.
Whoever wants to come.
Whoever there comes.
Yeah.
So I tend to think that's acceptable.
However, you are having pastors and elders there. Are you not creating an ecclesia ecclesioli? A little church inside the church where you are seeing the truly elect who are truly partaking, truly being the church without the rest of the church. That's my problem. Yeah. So I see what you are saying. The presbytery meets, they invite people to come, and it's open, worship service is open for everyone. And usually the guests are like, the people who is playing the piano or the instruments, and some other people from the guest church, and they still fence the table and everything. But it is still, again, not that I'm right, this is just a continental instinct. It still feels like we are refraining the elements from the larger church when you have such a big representatives from other churches, especially if we say we are united. That's my problem. And again, it's not a Presbyterian problem. It's a continental sensitivity, I guess. Does that make sense? More or less?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't agree with you. But
yeah, and that's okay. Again, it's not a Presbyterian problem. It's a continental sensitivity. Yeah, because of circumstances. So let me see. While presbytery is the agency that ratifies policy in some Presbyterian denominations, in others it tends to be the local church. For Presbyterians, Christ has granted authority to presbytery, not the local church. Full authority, by that I mean. For others, the fullest authority lies in the local church. So, let's say the GA has commanded that now we all are going to change of hymnals. Trinity hymnals are getting old. We are going to make another one, the new revised Trinity hymnal. I don't know. And General Assembly suggests that we all should adapt the new revised improved Trinity hymnal. Do you know who makes that decision? Presbytery. And they will say, yeah, we are going to decide whether we like it or not, whether we agree or not, and we are going to be sensitive to the needs of our churches. In other places, like RCUS or URCNA, is the local church who, after the synod has decided to do something, they go, you know what? We don't want to, because it's a lot of money. So we will continue using it until we can. Okay. Or, yeah, we are going to do it because it's something that our denomination has decided to do, and they will do it. Clearest, more recent example of that, the joint effort between the URCNA and the OPC regarding changing from the Trinity hymnal to the the Psalter Trinity hymnal, the Trinity Psalter, that's it. The URCNA adopted it very, very quickly because every single church said, why not? It's a good idea. The OPC, even to this day, you have whole presbyteries who don't have the new Trinity Psalter because they like the Trinity hymnal. So those differences make polity a little bit different with a little bit of a different flavor. Does that make sense? Just little tweaks here and there that make Presbyterianism and its application a little bit different. There are tons of advantage, though, to having a Presbyterian model of government. First of all, you have accountability for officers. Pastor nor elders are the bishops of the church. It's not how it is. We are transparent with one another, we submit to each other, and then we submit to the presbytery. Presbytery normally is inquiring about what are we doing, how are we are doing it, check the minutes of the sessions, and if we messed up, then they are going to pull our ears because of that. There is accountability, even at the level of the General Assembly. Second, is good for you. When a person has been sinned against, that person can come to the session. And let's say the sin is from the pastor. So what happens then? The session is with the pastor. No one is going to hear me. No, that's not true. You can file the case. Let's say the session ditches it and goes, no, we're not going to hear you. Once the session has ditched it, you can go, I'm going to elevate this to the presbytery level. And the presbytery, which is a broader, bigger assembly, will hear your case. And then let's say for some reason, your pastor is well connected, has tons of friends in the presbytery, all of them like him, and none of them are going to hear your case. Then you can, and presbytery ditches the case, you can go, oh yeah, I'm going to elevate it to the General Assembly level. And then 5,000 pastors are going to hear your case. And if it's warranted, then presbytery will be scolded, and then pastor will be scolded. And if that doesn't change, pastor will be deposed from ministry if he doesn't want to repent or anything. Case in point, very recent, OPC discipling case, discipline case with Amy Bird and the OPC pastor who was mocking her publicly on a Facebook group. She elevated the case to every single agency, and then General Assembly commanded the presbytery to recant from their views and from mocking her publicly. and they commanded the session to do that too. They didn't want to, and then they deposed the pastor. The pastor is no longer in the OPC because it was a good case. Now, did the girl went too crazy afterwards? Yes, she did. But that doesn't mean that she was wrong in the first place. But this is what I'm trying to say. The benefit of having a Presbyterian government is that you will be heard. You have courts to appeal to. The authority of the pastor is not the last one that you can appeal to. There is more levels, and you can be heard. Your case can be heard, and you can receive justice. It takes a long time, like anything. But it works more or less well. It doesn't work always, but it works more or less well. If you have any complaints against a church or something, you can be heard, which is better than what you find in other churches, by the way. Because if you're at odds with the pastor in other churches, who's going to hear you? Right? So that's the second benefit. Third, because we are not isolated, we benefit from greater wisdom of the visible church. We strive to show the unity of the church, just as Jesus himself said. So when we have a hard case that we are going to be thinking about, then we benefit from not just Christian, but other people who are smarter and have been in ministry for longer and have the experience and everything. And we discuss those things in presbytery and in general assembly. And as we have seen with the early church, although on a different level, God uses those meetings in order to bring clarity and solution to major issues that we are facing in the church. Another example of that right now is the struggle that we are having with language regarding identity, regarding who can be called pastor, elder, deacon in the church, and so on. And we are discussing those issues in General Assembly level. Once those are solved, we will come with a solution, and then there will be another issue that we will be pounding our heads about. That's how it works. And fifth, there is protection for the churches from bad teaching. Our pastors and elders examine candidates for ministry, not the congregation, and that is a good thing. A well-educated pastor can walk circles around the people. And who is going to say what you are saying is heresy if they don't know? But if you have other pastors who are well-educated too, and elders, representatives of the congregations, who examine that candidate, suddenly then you have another barrier to cross. And that is for the protection of the churches. We don't want heretics teaching in our pulpits, right? So it protects what we teach. Does that always work? Not always. And that depends on how serious do we take this and how broad we are in our understanding of what we teach. For example, in the OPC, you need to subscribe to the confession of faith. That is, you come to the front, you sign a document saying that you affirm the Westminster Confession of Faith. In the PCA, we say we affirm it, and the pastors are to believe it. But there is nothing that signs, or, you know, we just believe that what you are saying is true. We don't have any doubts to, we don't have any reasons to doubt about you. Even though sometimes in examinations, we are not totally certain. So PCA's subscription tend to be broader. Another narrower, even more narrow than an OPC's understanding is RCUS and URCNAs. They require pastor and elders to sign the subscription, and the congregation too. So here, you guys, you can believe whatever you want. You can come to TRPC, be members of TRPC. We will never ask you if you affirm the Westminster Confession of Faith. If you go to RCUS, you have to agree with the confessional standards. That's why when little children come to our session to make profession of faith, the only thing that we are going to ask them is if they love Jesus Christ, their testimony, and everything. If they go to a consistory in the RCUS, they are going to ask them how many questions of the Heidelberg they know by memory. They are going to ask them what such and such article of the Belgic Confession affirms such and such thing. And they are supposed to know those things. They are supposed to know what they believe because they subscribe to the confession too, the congregation that is. So again, differences. Which one is better? Which one is bad, good? It doesn't matter. Because from one perspective, all that the session cares is that we are seeing a credible profession of faith. A person can recite to me the Westminster Standards entirely and not be a Christian still. So it seems to me that in that sense, we tend to be more charitable than the Continentals are, but that's just my opinion. So some questions here. Who can attend presbytery? Anyone. If you want to go and see how it is, I'll be happy to bring you with me. Who can vote at presbytery? Pastors and elders only. Who can vote at General Assembly? Pastors and elders only. But we do designate commissioners to serve in different committees at the General Assembly level. Even here, another difference. OPC, 150 churches, I think, really small, so they can solve everything from the floor. They don't have a lot of committees. PCA, 5,000 pastors. And if we solve everything on the floor, it will never be over. So we have designated a committee of 120-something people, which is about the same size of the OPC. And they deliver over and meditate upon everything that we are going to decide. And then they give that to the General Assembly and we decide as a whole body. Mainly because of numbers. Like, can you imagine having this is Overture 1, similar to the other one that we already talked about, but from a different presbytery, so we need to vote. Does anyone have any opinion? Oh, believe me, there is going to be 50 people talking. This is not efficient, so we need to designate a committee to deal with that. However, it seems to me that this, as it stands today, PCA polity is deficient with regards to voting members. And that means we are kind of unfair with small churches. Here's the reason why. When you go to presbytery, you have, this church has the right to send pastor and two elders. That's three votes for presbytery. If we have more than 500 members, we have an extra elder. So that's four votes. But if you have another pastor, you have another vote. If you have another pastor, you have another vote. If you have another pastor, you have another vote. So if you have a church of 2,000 people and you have lead pastor, assistant pastor, pastor of families, pastor of communion, pastor of communication, pastor of social media, pastor of sound, pastor of guitar, then you have seven votes. That's what I'm saying. They are pastors. Yeah. Yeah, they are pastors. They have been ordained. That's the issue we're talking about. Yeah. Yeah. You may think it's not a thing. Gulf Coast. I don't remember. Gulfstream Presbytery examined a pastor for Spanish River Church. Huge church. He was to be the pastor of communications. What is that? What is a pastor of communications? Oh yeah, I'll be, you know, handling social media, making some newsletters, and and then I'll be teaching some Bible studies. Okay. So when you have that, when you are a big church and you can pay that, then you have more votes. And that's not good for the denomination. Me thinks. How does it work in other denominations? So in other denominations, for example, the RCUS and the URC, they designate two members from consistory to go to classes, and then two members from classes to go to synod, and only them can vote. That's better, I think, because then you are designated just two. Your church can be huge. Your church can be 20, it can have 20 pastors, but only two vote, because only two represent one church. I think that's better. It's more representative than, now we are facing a challenge. Let's say we are just at odds with, let's say Pastor Christian was stupid, did something stupid and imprudent on Twitter, and he insulted the pastor of Village 7. And now we need to decide the case upon presbytery. Pastor of Village 7 brings his seven pastors, and I come by myself. I doubt that's going to happen, not because I'm not imprudent, I'm very imprudent, but because that's not how it solve we will solve the case. But my point is, it's very unfair with smaller churches. Doesn't give us a voice to speak. So I think that's a deficiency. Again, that's just my idea. Whether that's true or not, that's just my observation. All right. Do you have any questions so far?
We better get more
Yeah. So we have two votes. Yeah. Yeah, so the PCA feels like a full democracy, and yeah. All right. Do you have any questions? Yeah.
So what is the press?
Because all of those guys from those big churches are their friends, and they are not going to vote against his friend. So that's politics of the church. Yeah. That's exactly my point. Yeah. Beth? No, I think no, because we have huge churches in the PCA who are very, very faithful. But I think what we see in the PCA is the result of our decision regarding subscription and how we understand the Westminster Standards. We tend to be more lax in our subscription language. As I said, we just believe you, period. Whereas in other places, you have to sign a document, and that document holds you accountable of what you are going to teach. And over that, they have church examiners, church visitors who are visiting the churches all the time, because they have the power to check the churches and say, hey, you are not teaching this in agreement with our standards. What is going on? And so you can get in trouble because of that. There was. I think it's before the 90s, Mel.
Didn't have to sign anything, but I also was not allowed to take exceptions. The exceptions started 02, 2002 or something like
Okay.
that, 2001.
Yeah. That's been fairly common in the Presbyterian American world. So for you to have an idea, 1717, which is the First Presbytery and they examined the first candidates, there were some guys who were taking exceptions to lots of things. Now we, at least we have reduced them to two things, Second Commandment issues, important issues, Second Commandment and Fourth Commandment. And the Fourth Commandment, normally they take exception to the clause on recreation, which means I don't think it's a sin to play with my kids. That's not the issue, but that's what they say. And the Second Commandment has to do with mental images of Jesus Christ. The context is worship, first of all. It seems like it's always surprising to me that they don't understand that. The context is worship. If you are making a mental image of Jesus Christ in your head and you are saying, oh, that's Jesus, and then you are worshiping that idea, that's idolatry. Okay, that's the issue. But then they go, I don't think it's a sin to watch The Chosen. Well, The Chosen first of all, is distorting who Jesus is, right? If you have heard what people say about The Chosen, if your Jesus is not like the Jesus of The Chosen, then it's not a good Jesus. Okay, well, okay, now the standard is The Chosen, not the scriptures. But, you know, for a pastor to say that is serious, because now he's saying not only that he enjoys the TV show, but that he is going to use it as an evangelism tool. Why do you want to use that when we have scriptures, right? Those are some of the issues that we struggle with right now. Those are the only two that people normally take. There are others that people take, yes. But those are not as normal. There was one in this presbytery that I was told about that he took exception to the language of the larger catechism regarding the government, because the larger catechism was never changed and it affirms that the government has to defend the church and things like that. And he's like, we don't have that here in America, so why would I affirm that? And but that's like one out of like the ones that they always take exception to. Yeah. Yep. To GA? I think you could you not? So if we believe that the examination was flimsy and that he shouldn't have been approved, I think we can elevate that to GA. Yeah. Yeah, we can. Yeah. Oh, we should do that.
What kind of governance does the Presbyterian General Assembly have over, you know, the denomination have over things like property? Like in the '70s when the CCUSA, when the churches were taking exception to the direction.
Yeah.
Because they actually were possessed church
buildings. Yeah. Like yeah. No. Because of that, buildings belong to us. Property belongs to us, not to the denomination. And that's why we have a board of trustees, because they are taking care of those things, because it's the churches, not the denominations. Ron?
I was just going to clarify, I think you referred to this a minute ago, but the Westminster Confession has been revised over the years, different times, and I think even now Dr. Strange mentioned in his little article that he's a part of a
Yeah.
That exception you were talking about, that's what it's referring to. Way back.
Yeah, yeah. So the revision has to do with language, the one that they are working on right now, modernizing English, not necessarily doctrine though. So that's what's going on there. But recreation, the context of recreation that no one mentions again, is that when the assembly was gathering, the context behind that language is that the previous king had required that on Sunday you need to go and play games. There was even a book given to you and to the churches that you needed to read from the pulpit. And after the service, make sure to play polo, is it? That little thing that British people like to play? Yeah, that thing. You need to, you know, I don't know, but you need to go and do it. So now the king is forcing you to violate your conscience. That's what he's referring to. So it makes sense to say no recreations if someone is forcing you to do that. So that's more or less the context behind that. Do you have any other questions before we go into the elder and the local church? No? Okay. So if you want to find out more, Calvin's Institutes, Samuel Miller's The Presbyterianism, The History of Presbyterianism, Thomas Witherow, The Apostolic Church, which is it? And there is another one I'm forgetting right now. Those are short articles or booklets that speak about this that we are going to talk about. If you can find you can put your hands into Gualebius's treatment on the government of the church, that's just good too. Shorter than any other one. So he affirms there are four officers, pastors, doctors, elders, and deacons. And let's see the elder. Now, it's interesting that the first time in the scriptures where we find the term elder is Exodus 3:16. That is very early, second book of the Bible. And it's mentioned in such a way that all their tasks are assumed. This is like, ah, yeah, by the way, the elders are there. So it's always been there. They have always performed this task kind of thing. We have always had a precedent. Why would we change that? That's kind of like the idea behind. Let me just read it to you. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt. See, so God is instructing Moses to talk to the representatives of the people, the elders, who are to hear what God has to say and has to do, is going to do with the whole people of Israel. He's not calling everyone. He's calling to the leaders of the assembly of Israel. Now, the term here is zaken. That's the weird-looking thing that you have in your handouts. Zaken simply means old man. That's what it means. Just like elder in English, old man. The description is, we find in 3:16 seems to presuppose that the elders mentioned here are in charge or are leaders, representatives of the people. This is what is interesting. There is no explanation about their origin. It's just assumed. It's presupposed that they are in charge. Now, there are two possible origins of this. First, it could be cultural. It's not natural respect for those who have white hair, right, in those ancient Near Eastern cultures. And because they are wise, they have lived longer. Some of them got typhus, survived, you know, and he's still around. That's cool, you know. He knows better. We are going to make them leaders because they have wisdom. So it will make sense that they are the natural option for leadership. After all, young people tend to be stupid, to rush into decisions and everything. So don't think about young people. Think about the ones who have experience, who can look back and say, "Yeah, no, let's be prudent." Makes sense. Tribal societies similar to Israel tended to be ruled by the elderly, because of their wisdom. So it's not only Israel who had that, but the other societies around them seem to have been ruled by elders as well. The second option is, it could be that at some point in Israel's history, God indicated in a special form of revelation that elders were responsible for representing, ruling over the people of Israel in both civil and ecclesiastical matters. Which one is right?
Well, so that was my question, because in Exodus 18, Jethro comes to Moses and says, go into the formal system of education. government.
Yeah. That's
so it's also elders coming with Aaron.
Yeah. That's after 3:16, right? So there was already there a form of government. Yes. So the second option sounds more godly, more pious, more interesting, but there is no evidence for it in the Bible. And in fact, if we go with the second, then we will ignore the ways in which God normally works. God works through normal, organic means. He doesn't despise anything. He uses what is already there. Think about sacrifices, temples, and things like that in the Old Testament. Every other religion around Israel has those. Very similar. Do you know why God uses those? Because he wants to speak to the people in a language that they understand, in a residual language of the garden, by the way. So it was already there in the garden, is residually remembered by people, so they corrupt that knowledge that they have, making their own temples and everything. God comes, redeems it, and uses it for his glory in revealing himself to Israel. In the same way, societies around Israel have elders, they have elders. It has always been the case. God comes, uses them for his purpose in order to rule his people. That's how it works. That's how even as we will see, our form of government works as well. It was used before, and that's precisely what we are going to see now. So in other parts of the Bible, the elders are responsible for being representatives of God's people. Exodus 3:18 speaks about the elders going to the presence of Pharaoh, and they will listen to your voice, and you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews. See, so the elders, Moses and Aaron, are going before the presence of Pharaoh. We have other texts there. They ruled and made judgments over the people, Deuteronomy 19:12. Then the elders of his city shall send and take him from there and hand him over to the avenger of blood so that he may die. This is talking about the laws when someone kills someone without or with intention and they find him out. Then the elders of the city come and they are the ones who execute justice. They are judges in that sense. They are helpers to Moses. That's Numbers 11 that Beth just talked about. 70 elders with the Spirit of God who are going to help Moses with decisions and judgments and things like that. They are to know the law and to aid the Levites in calling people of Israel to hear it. Deuteronomy 31. Then Moses wrote this law and gave it to the priests, the sons of Levi, who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, and to all the elders of Israel. So they are to know it too. They are to read it as well. The role of the elder finds its heights, is highest expression in the office of the king. The king in Israel was supposed to exercise all of the above tasks with the help of the elders. And there is a transition from the Pentateuch to the rest of the books. The elders are ruling, and suddenly you have the book of the judges, and the judges are ruling now. And then the judge basically is a little king in small areas. Then that is taken up by the king. And the king rules over everything else with the help of the elders of the people. So when David is about to be crowned, the leaders, the elders, and the commanders come before King David and from Israel, and they are the ones who receive him as king. Just as the elders are described in the role of judges, so the king also is a judge. And all Israel heard of the judgment that the king had rendered. See, that's King Solomon. And they stood in awe of the king because they perceived that the wisdom of God was in him to do justice. So king is a judge as well. The king too is a representative of God's people. This is the interesting thing in the book of Kings. As the king goes, so the people too. And sometimes the people is wicked, rebellious, and everything, but the king is good. And because of that, God doesn't punish the people. Reading between the lines, Hezekiah's story. He comes after the most nastiest period in the land of Judah. And Hezekiah's reforms don't mean that he crashed everything. He actually just officially removed idolatry, but people continued. The Bible even says so. People continued worshiping in the altars. King is good. He's obeying the law, but the people is not. And when Hezekiah dies and the other guy dies, Manasseh comes. And Manasseh is a disaster. And do you know what the book of Chronicles and Kings says? God sent them into exile because of Manasseh. So Manasseh, the king, is representative of the people of Israel. Exile because of him. So they is kind of like a funnel where everything is directed to the king. Whatever the king does affects the whole nation. And many times the destiny of the whole nation, as I said, is tied with the king. I have another example here. This is not Manasseh. This is Joash. Now, after the death of Jehoiada, the princes of Judah came and paid homage to the king. Then the king listened to them, and they abandoned the house of the Lord, the God of their fathers, and served the Asherim and the idols. And listen to this. And wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this guilt of theirs. So because of what the king and the princes did, God is mad with the whole nation. King is representative of the people, just as the elders were representatives of the Israelite tribes. In times of exile, the office of king disappears from the picture from a time. The exiled community still survived in exile, though, in the gathering of the synagogues. Not surprisingly, the natural